After wishing everyone good morning, and thanks for coming. Boker Tov. Now we're coming close to Rosh Hashanah, and I do want to speak to you a little bit about Rosh Hashanah, if that's okay. But first let's finish up our series, because this is the last year in the series in which we're discussing matters of life and death. And I take those matters pretty seriously, and I'm sure you all do as well. We were speaking, if you remember, 2 weeks ago about a pregnant woman who might subject herself to surgery in order to save the life of the fetus. And the question is, does a person have an obligation to endanger his life for the sake of someone else? That's the question I want to address today, and then, if it's Hashem, talk a little bit about Rosh Hashanah. The first source on your page will already begin to indicate how the Torah values life. Life is sanctity. Life is the ultimate. V'chai b'hem. The Torah gives us the mitzvahs in order to live by them. V'lo sheyamus b'hem. And if I see someone whose life is in peril, I have to do whatever I can to save him. For example, the Gemara says, "Minayin l'ro'es chaver shu tovei benar." He sees his friend who is drowning in the river. How do we know? Or the Gemara gives another scenario that attackers are coming, or an animal is grabbing this person. How do I know shu chayv latzilo, that he cannot stand idly, but rather he has to do whatever he can in order to save his friend's life? And this is derived, says the Gemara, from the pasuk, "Lo tamod al dam reyach, thou shalt not stand idly while the blood of your friend is spilled." And as I've indicated many times, you may remember this, that Jewish ethics is not all about minding your own business. That's a Western concept. But rather you have to get involved. The Gemara says, well, what happens if I can't jump in and save him? I don't have senior life saving. So the Gemara says, you've got to hire someone to save him. If you can. Again, every situation is different. The Gemara adds to Lo Tamod Al Dam Reyecha another aspect, and that is a mitzvah saseh, a positive command, which is derived from a parasha called Hashavas Aveda, meaning I'm obligated to return your object to you if it's lost, and I can return it to you. How much more so do I have to return your life to you if your life is in danger? And this is the great principle, the overarching great principle of saving someone's life. Those who have the opportunity to fulfill this great mitzvah, it's a blessing. And we need people to save other people. That's the Torah philosophy that's embedded both in law, in Jewish halacha, and also in Jewish ethics. But, on the other hand, there is another principle which seems to contradict this one. And this was formulated by Rabbi Akiva, namely, Chayecha kodmin l'chayecha vercha. Let me try to translate that. Your life comes before his life. And Rabbi Akiva, based on this, says that if you are with a friend in the desert and there's only enough water for one of you, you have the water, you drink the water. Why? Because you save yourself. He will perish. But chayecha kodmin l'chayecha vercha. So look, if I can save someone without imperiling my life, then that goes without saying. Lo tamod, hashavas aveda, the mitzvah, the lo saseh, everything fits into place. But life becomes complicated, as it always does in halacha, when you're faced with the situation of endangering your own life, risk-taking for the sake of hatzolah. If we apply the principle of Rabbi Akiva that your life comes first, you have the water, you save your life, you don't imperil yourself and risk and endanger yourself by giving the water up to someone else, then, with all the respect to the great mitzvah of Hatzolah, but that mitzvah has to step aside the very moment you are risking your life for the sake of someone else. And as we discussed before, in the case of a woman who would have to subject herself to the dangers of surgery, and we're talking about full anesthesia, you know, we're talking about a real bona fide surgical operation. We're not talking about, you know, today, Baruch Hashem, the techniques and the technology has advanced, and you can have situations where you can actually have parts of your body removed from you without endangering your life, because there are all sorts of different procedures, and now they have laser surgery and so forth and so on. But we're talking about a case of surgery. We're talking about a situation of donating a kidney for someone. Again, today, Baruch Hashem, again, we have to thank God for the miracles of Vikav Shua that we spoke about, that man can conquer the universe, and we have a 99% success in a case of a donor kidney. But what about a case where there's a 50% chance that your life will be in danger because of the organ donation that you want to give? What about a case of a person who has to expose himself to disease? He may be a physician, but the disease is so contagious and so life-threatening that he would expose himself to danger if he dealt with this patient. What about the case of what's called here in Israel a chablan, which is a person who has to take apart a bomb, you know, that was left by a terrorist that might explode? Well, we've known, unfortunately, cases of chablanim who have endangered their lives, and if not their lives, organs of their body, for the sake of saving others. So if you take a look at the second source on your page, you will see that there is a principle in the Gemara called Maichazus. Now, again, if we had an hour, we would go through this sugya, this Gemara, line by line. I'm going to make life short for us, and, I mean a shortcut for us, and I'm going to apply the principle of Maichazus. And this was an actual case that came up in the Gemara. Somebody asked Rava this question. The governor, the non-Jewish governor, was threatening my life unless I kill someone else. Can I kill someone else to save my own life? And the Gemara says no. Rava says, my chazus, who says that your blood is redder than his? Maybe his blood is redder than yours. And Rashi explains, who's more beloved in the eyes of the Creator? So you can't make that judgment call. Therefore, the Gemara says you have to be passive. Do nothing. What you'll see how things develop. Yeah.
If it's really a famous person that would be killed instead of player.
So it's very interesting that you say that, because everyone points to Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi talks about a case where one of the greats of the generation was taken captive. I mentioned this to you last week, if you recall. And Reish Lakish says, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to fight the battle. Either I'll die, I'll get killed, or I'll save him and I'm going to kill him, the captor, and then I can save the captive. So the poskim want to say that according to the Yerushalmi, clearly Reish Lakish is teaching us that you have to put your life into danger in order to save someone else from a definite danger. And other poskim say, no, that's an exceptional case, because they took Rav Ami captive and he was the Gol Ador, he was the greater generation. Others say that Reish Lakish took it upon himself on a voluntary basis. We shouldn't derive conclusions and have to imitate Reish Lakish, because Reish Lakish was doing it out of the goodness of his heart. It was an act of piety, of what we call chassidut. And that even if the Torah doesn't require you to put your life into danger, you're allowed to do so. And then we get back to Rabbi Akiva of Chayecha Kodman. What did Rabbi Akiva mean when he said your life comes first? Did he mean that you have no right to give up the water because you have to spare, you have to save your own life? Or did he say you're not obligated to give up your life, but you can do so? So we're going to now have a whole bunch of cases in which we're going to take the maichazus of this second source on your page, and we're going to flip it the other way around. Do I have to put my life into danger to save his life? Well, that would assume that his blood is redder than mine. Now, it's true, I can't kill someone to save myself, because I can't make that judgment call that my life is more valuable than his, but on the other hand, flip it around. Is his life more valuable than mine? So why should I be required to put my life into danger in order to save someone else? And here I want to bring to your attention the breakthrough of the Minchas Chinuch. The Minchas Chinuch was a giant amongst giants in terms of his mind. You probably could have made a couple of Einsteins out of him. And what he claims is that there's a simple answer to this question. The Torah says, V'chaimahem, you shall live by the precepts of the Torah. V'loshiyomus behem. And you don't die for the Torah. So the Torah says, Lo tamen al dam reyacha. The Torah says, you see someone drowning, jump in if you can save him, and do so. Fine, but does that mean I have to give up my life for the sake of Lo tamod al dam reyacha? Again, Lo tamod al dam reyacha means that you cannot stand idly by and someone is going to die. There are only three cases which are exceptions to the rule of a chayim. Only three cases where the Torah says you have to give up your life rather than violate the precepts of the Torah. What are those three cases? I'm asking this not as a rhetorical question. I want to hear your answers.
Idol worship.
Idol worship. That's avodah zarah.
Yeah.
What else?
Murder.
Murder. Right. I can't murder someone to save my life. There's no chayim. And number three is gilui arayos, which means immorality. The mitzvah of saving someone, as great as it is, lo tamad ol dam reyacha, is not on the list. Says the Minchas Chinuch, if I have to preserve my life, because the Torah says, v'chaimahem, you shall live by them, then you can only override that principle of v'chaimahem in three cases. Well, lo tamad ol dam reyacha is not one of the three cases. We have 6, 10, and we have 3. Lo Tamod belongs in a category of the 6, 10. It's not one of the big three. Says the Minchas Chinuch, therefore I submit to you, there's a simple answer to your question. Do you have to put your life into danger, risk your life for the sake of someone else's life? Are you going to tell me that his blood is redder than yours? What about the principle of Achaimahem? You can't override the principle of Achaimahem. Unless it's one of the big three, but this is not one of the big three. Is that clear? I mean, the logic of the Minchas Chinuch is so compelling that you even begin to wonder why this was an issue at all. However, on the other side, we have the Yerushalmi, that Reish Lakish put his life into danger to save someone else. And he admitted going in from the get-go that they might kill him. And I guess unless we say that Reish Lakish is an exception to the rule, if we look at Reish Lakish as establishing a precedent, then his ruling was that you do have to put your life into danger to save someone else. And here we have a breakthrough of the Hagos Maimonides. The Hagos Maimonides, I'll show it to you inside, Belinender, was one of the greatest commentaries on the Rambam of all times. In fact, most of the commentaries on the Rambam, with the exception of two, were Achronim. Achronim usually means in the last 5 centuries. There are 2 Rishonim who lived between the time of the Rambam and, you know, the 15th century, in that period of time, who commented on the Rambam. One of them is called Hagos Maimonides. He was an Ashkenazi. Most of the commentaries on the Rambam were Sfaradim. And he writes that although the Yerushalmi seems to indicate that Reish Lakish put his life into danger to save someone else's life, but where do you find this in the Poskim? Why isn't it quoted? Not in the Rambam, not in the Tur, not in the Shulchan Aruch. Nowhere do you find this dictum that we should derive from the Yerushalmi of Reish Lakish that a person has to put his life into danger to save someone else. How could they have missed the beat? We are talking about the Rambam. The Rambam writes in his introduction, again, it's very hard for me to say this because it borders on heresy, but the Rambam writes it. And the Rambam says that all you have to do is read my book, and from my book, you can know everything. It's a self-contained entity. So go through Tanakh, and after you get your exam on the Tanakh, you know, you passed your exam with flying colors, you came in first in the Chidona Tanakh, now just read my compendium of Halacha and skip everything in between. Meaning, it's all in the Rambam. That's what he claims. And he calls it the Mishneh Torah. The Mishneh Torah means it's like a substitute for the Torah itself. Well, wait a second. If that's what the Rambam is telling me, that all the rules are written in the Rambam, where does it say in the Rambam that I have to put my life into danger to save someone else's life? How could the Rambam have omitted such an important, stupendous halakha that has such tremendous repercussions for life and death? Says that goes my money, is the Rambam deliberately omitted it. Because the Rambam looked into the Bavli, as opposed to the Yerushalmi, and he found no source in the Bavli that would indicate what we saw in Reish Lakish in the Yerushalmi. How could it be that the Bavli never formulated this principle requiring me to put my life into danger to save someone else? Could that have been omitted from the Bavli? Okay, you have a Yerushalmi, Reish Lakish. Very beautiful. But we paskin like the Bavli. Now, please don't misunderstand me. The Rambam takes the Yerushalmi very seriously. There are many, many cases in which the Yerushalmi paskins like the Rambam paskins like the Yerushalmi. But in this case, the Rambam left it out. That was a deliberate omission because the halacha is v'chai bohem. You have to live by the Torah, not give up your life for the Torah, even for the great mitzvah of Hatzolos and the Nefashos. And we're going to apply the principle of Rabbi Akiva Chayecha Kodmin.
What about your state of mind? Like, you give it to your person, say, okay, you live, and I'm
going
to die.
Great. So here we have a tremendous controversy. Even if I agree to the Agos Maimonides, that I'm not obligated or mandated to put my life into danger, can I do so? And here's where the poskim are divided. One school of thought says, look, you saw Reish Lakish put his life in this, so you want to tell me he didn't have to do so, but he did so. Apparently, he couldn't live with himself. He could not live with himself allowing the Gadol Hador to be killed. And therefore, he took upon himself to go beyond the letter of the law, even though he wasn't obligated to do so, to put his life on the line to save someone.
What if they decided to divide the amount of God together?
What you're saying, I believe, is Ben Petura. You know, Ben Petura, who's quoted very rarely, but here he's the big man, he argues against Rabbi Akiva. He says they split the water. And now the question is, what kind of logic is that? Does that bother you? You're going to split the water.
I would split it with my husband or something.
Okay, split it with your husband. You know, split it with your Siamese twin. I don't care who you split it with, but you're both going to perish. So what did you gain by splitting the water? So some want to say, you know what? A person is desperately dehydrated in the hot sun of the desert, but half the water will get him somewhere. Maybe he'll be able to get, you know, he'll move a couple of meters, and who knows? Maybe he'll make it to the Yishuv, and he'll be able to hydrate himself. So some want to say, I have a problem with this, I'll tell you why, that Ben Petura thinks that we should cut our losses. Let's do damage control. Let's split the water and hope that both of us will survive.
Because it's hard to live with the fact that you didn't try to save the other person.
I don't know. I personally, again, you know, we can argue for this from now to Tuesday, I would have no problem drinking the water. It's my water, and I'm going to drink it. And if you want to steal the water from me, that's a rodent. You're threatening my life. It's my water. Others say, what do you mean it's your water? Do you own? Okay, technically you own the water, but life itself is the water. The water goes way beyond ownership. You know, if I steal this table from you, so you'll sue me in a court of law for 150 shekels. You know what I'm saying? But that's not what this water is about. If you would sell this water down on Ben Yehuda Street, you're not going to get 5 prutos for it. But in the case of life and death, that water represents something that goes way beyond its market value. But Rabbi Akiva says, it's your water. So imagine you are drowning and somebody throws you a life buoy. So you're going to say, well, I'm not going to grab onto the life buoy because if I do so, then someone else is going to perish. No! Says Rabbi Akiva, go ahead and save yourself. That's called v'chaibah. You're not killing anyone. You're not, there's one thing, if the Torah says shvichas dam, you can't kill someone and say, but I don't have to say that in this situation of life and death, well, his blood is redder than mine, right? It goes in both directions, as we said before. I would have no problem. I wouldn't lose any sleep over drinking the water. Maybe I would. I don't know. I never had the situation.
Depends on the other person.
You know, it's Erev Rosh Hashanah, so I have to say things that are, you know, pretty serious here. We're talking about life and death. And you know, Sifrei Chayim and Sifrei Mason, you know, who's gonna survive? But the halacha in, you know, I've always said this to you. Halacha is very legalistic in a certain sense. Yesterday, I gave a shiur on artificial insemination. The big opponent, historically, to artificial insemination in the 20th century was, anybody know who he was? The opponent. Rav Moshe was the advocate. It was the Satmar Rav.
He was against it.
He was against it. To him, it was a matter of life and death. And you know, usually debates in halacha are a little bit toned down. There's some elegance and respect. But here, there was no elegance. I mean, without mentioning Rav Moshe Feinstein's name, I mean, the Satmar Rav in five different tshuvas, you know, says that anyone who could advocate such a despicable, unethical act, you know, we're talking about a donor who's not her husband. And, you know, saying if her husband's donor is a halvitz, or even that he was supposed to. But imagine a donor, a sperm donor from a bank, and it's not her husband, and she's married to a man. He considers it adultery. Now, why do I mention this to you? Because the Satmar Rav quotes a to prove his point, he quotes a Ramban in his commentary on the Torah. The Ramban in his commentary on the Torah gives us an insight as to why the Torah is absolutely opposed to adultery. When I say absolutely opposed, I mean, obviously it's one of the cardinal sins, it's a capital crime, etc., etc. I could talk about this till doomsday. How severe is the violation of adultery? And Chazal say over and over again that God chose the Jewish people because in this area they were very, very careful. God adds his own name to every one of the Shvatim, if you remember in Parashas Bamidbar, a Yud K at the end, in order to testify that their lineage is pure. There was no hanky-panky. Comes along the Satmar Rav and he quotes the Ramban. The Ramban says, why is the Torah so opposed to adultery? Because we'll never be able to know who the father of this child is. We have to be able to identify the parent. And the Satmar Rav takes this Ramban all the way to the end. And he says that according to the Ramban, this kind of artificial insemination is the same as adultery. Because at some point, you have no clue who the father is. You know, there's sperm banks and the donors, and it's going back and forth. Today, by the way, it's a little bit more under governmental control. You know, the hospitals have to, you know, they have to be very careful about labeling the tubes, if you know what I'm saying. But back in the time of Satmar Rav, he was afraid of total anarchy. We're not going to know who's the father and who's the son. So Moshe Feinstein, his response to the Satmar Rav, again, without quoting it by name, he says, how can you quote a Ramban who's giving you a philosophical insight into his own personal speculation about why the Torah is so opposed to immorality, to adultery, and use that in a halachic discussion? You're crossing all the bounds. This is beyond the halachic way of thinking. Halachic man thinks in terms of categories. If the Ramban wants to offer in a speculative way his own personal insight into why the Torah this and why the Torah that, and he wants to, you know, the Ramban wants to take it upon himself to analyze the mindset of Almighty God, okay, that's wonderful. And that's great for a drasha, you know, before Musaf on Shabbos, but that's not the way we decide halacha. Halacha is very regimented, it's very rigorous. It operates with categories. And one of the categories is that you're not allowed to kill someone in order to save your life. But if I'm not killing someone, he's dying because I'm saving my own life, that's already v'chai b'hem. That's okay. That's chayech hakod. So for example, you remember the question of Rav Ashri that we touched on a few weeks ago, when the Nazis rounded up 1,400 kids to be killed on Rosh Hashanah in 1941. How many years ago is that, by the way? Because maybe this Rosh Hashanah is a round number. I don't know. 41, that's 59. How much is 59 plus 20? Ah, okay. It's almost coming to 70. So we're talking about an event that took place 70 years ago where the father came to Rav Ashri. Rav Ashri didn't look like the Gol Hadar in the camps. And he asked him, I smuggled out a diamond ring, or I don't remember what it was, but something of value. I can bribe the capo and save my son. So Rav Ashri asked him, what's the shaila?
Yeah.
So he said, because there's no question that another child will be taken to replace my son. And basically, I'm saving my son at the expense of some other child. Because the number was 1,400. And the capo had to live up to that requirement. And the story goes that Rav Ashri couldn't give him an answer. Back and forth, he kept badgering the rabbi. The rabbi said to him, your question would have to be brought in front of the highest court of Israel, the Sanhedrin HaGadol. And you're looking at me? Now, I don't have to describe what he looked like, and you're asking for a response? So the man, the father who asked this question, understood that Rav Ashri had serious doubts as to whether this was allowed, to save yourself at the expense of someone else. And at the end, he did nothing, and his child perished. And on that Rosh Hashanah, he turns to Almighty God, and he says to him, my nisayon, my challenge is greater than that of Avraham Avinu, because Avraham Avinu at the end of the day did not slaughter his son Yitzchak. Yitzchak survived, but my son perished. Imagine saying that to the Ribbono Shel Olam on Rosh Hashanah. So getting back to our issue, Rabbi Akiva seems to say, if you could save yourself, save yourself. So Rav Chaim Brisker comes along and he asks the following question. He says, did Rabbi Akiva come up with this logic on his own? Take a look at the Gemara. I think it's the third source on your page. Rabbi Akiva quotes a verse. The pasuk says, V'chei achicha imach, at the end of Sefer Vayikra. Let your brother live with you. Says Rabbi Akiva, he is tafil, he's secondary to you. He should live with you, imach. Again, you have to know more about biblical and Torah Shebaal Peh, understanding of biblical Hebrew. In the way Chazal understand biblical Hebrew, the word imach, with you, means he's secondary to you. That's called a tafil. But you're primary. And therefore, Rabbi Akiva derives from this pasuk, chayecha kodmi l'chay chavercha. It sounds like, says Rabbi Chaim Brisker, that logically, Ben Keturah was right. Split the water. You have no right to drink that water and he'll perish. You cannot save yourself at the expense of someone else's dying, even though you're not killing him actively. But Rabbi Akiva had a drasha. He had a pasuk. He had a verse. And the way he interpreted the verse, he came to the conclusion that chayecha kodmin. But that was in a very specific case. When did Rabbi Akiva apply chayecha kodmin? You're holding on to the water. But does that mean that Rabbi Akiva would allow you to actively go out and try to save yourself by grabbing onto something which Yenim, which somebody else could grab onto, and he would save himself? So the Rabbi Chaim understood that, why did Rabbi Akiva need a verse? This is, by the way, this is a Talmudic principle that, not for now, but in methodology, it's unbelievable. Whenever you can derive something within the logical framework of halacha, you don't quote a pasuk. Whenever the Gemara quotes a pasuk, and a verse and a derivation from a verse, you know that it's not logically compelling. It's only because of the verse. So Reb Chaim says, you see from Rabbi Akiva that logically it's not so simple for you to drink the water. The answer is, you're drinking the water. That's a natural act. You're not going out of your way to do this act and grabbing onto something which somebody else could vie for. But as a general rule, says Reb Chaim, to actively pursue Hatzolah to save yourself, knowing full well that as a result somebody's going to die, even Rabbi Akiva would prohibit that. So this is the fantastic Chiddush of Reb Chaim. So again, let's go back to Hagos Maimonides. Hagos Maimonides says, why didn't the Rambam tell me somewhere in his compendium that I have to put my life into danger at a risk in order to save someone else? The Rambam omitted it deliberately, because that's not the halacha. Either you shall me, that's Reish Lakish, and that's perhaps voluntary, but it's not obligatory according to the law. So you tell me I can't live with myself. Okay, that's, do what you want. Do you want to save someone and perish? Okay, fine. That's your decision. But the halacha doesn't mandate that. That was the conclusion of Hagos Maimonides. Now, fast forward by 3 centuries, we're now in the 16th century and we're in the city of Tzfat, and we have Rav Yosef Karo. So Rav Yosef Karo writes a super commentary on the Rambam called the Kesef Mishnah. And he puts Hagos Maimonides on the side And he writes the following. We have another halachic principle. And that's called Ein Sofek Motzi Midei Vaday. What does that mean? Okay, very difficult to translate that into English. But I'll give you the gist of it. The gist of it is, if you have a certain situation versus a doubt situation, then drop it on the doubt situation. Go back to the certain situation. The Vaday, the certainty, creates a kind of assumption in Halacha, and that's a chazaka, and then you can't remove that chazaka unless you know definitely that with a vada, but it's not a vada against it. So it's a suffix. So what does the Kesef Mishnah do? How does he apply this principle of Ein Suffix Motzi Midei Vada? Says the Kesef Mishnah, your friend is going to perish. You know that with certainty. There's no question about it. If you do nothing, he will die. You're putting your life at risk. But that's only a suffix. That's only a doubt. Ein suffix, Motzi Midei Vada. His certainty is greater and trumps your suffix, your doubt. Will you survive? Will you not survive? We don't know. But one thing we do know for sure, he's going to perish if you do nothing. If the game would have ended here, I hear the logic of the Kesef Mishnah. But the Kesef Mishnah wrote another work later in his life. What's that? The Shulchan Aruch. And in the Shulchan Aruch, he completely omits it. It's a mind-boggling situation. And the one who addresses this lived about a century ago. He was called the Aruch HaShulchan. Have you heard of him? He wrote his own version of the Shulchan Aruch. He was like the Mishnah Berurah in his time. His name was Epstein. He was one of the great Rabbanim, the rabbis of Lydda. And he's perplexed. You know, the Kesef Mishnah on the one hand says, jump in, put your life into risk, because he's going to perish for sure. And yet, when he gets to compose the Shulchan Aruch, which is the final compendium of Halacha, he omits it. And the Aruch HaShulchan comes to the final conclusion. You're not obligated to put your life into danger to save someone else. However, he says, listen carefully. He says, don't fool yourself. What does it mean that you're putting your life into danger? A lot of people in this situation would jump the gun and they're going to say, well, my life is in danger. So he says, again, this is Berzon's formulation, but he says, think about it over and over again, 1,000 times. Don't jump to any conclusions. Are you really being honest with yourself? Is it really such a terrible danger? And the poskim, who decide halacha, take this Aruch HaShulchan, and they develop it. And they ask the following question. What is called a serious risk? How much of a percentage, statistically, is significant enough that the halacha would be, I don't have to put my life into danger. Again, we're talking about the level of mandate, of obligation. We're not talking about someone who wants to be pious beyond the letter of the law. He's going to put his life into danger when it's a 50-50 chance that he'll perish in order to save someone else. That's the case of Mishnah Ein Sofek Motzi Midei Vada. But we're talking about the strict letter of the law. The Mechaber in Shulchan Aruch never mentions that you should have to put your life into danger. What is considered a risk? What is considered putting your life into danger? And I'm going to tell you something that makes no sense to me. It took an author in the 21st century, did you hear me? 21st century, to come up to take this, you know, take the bull by the horns and come up with an answer. And this is Rabbi Yitzchok Zilberstein. I don't know if you've heard of him. I think I mentioned him in the past. He's the son-in-law of Rabbi Yoshin, but that's not his yichus. He's great on his own. And you should know they've translated tons of his books into English. He's one of the most popular writers today, authors today, on any halachic issue. And all the modern shilas, you know, the technology and so forth, they bring to Rabbi Zilberstein. And he says he thinks he can solve this problem. What is considered a serious risk in halacha? Mind-boggling chiddush. I'll give you a little background. I don't know if you've heard of something in halacha which is called onah. Does anybody know what onan means? Onan means overcharging. There's a market price for this table. The market price for this table is 100. I overcharge you and you pay me more than 100. If you can prove that there was an onah here, that I overcharged you, then you have a right to cancel the sale and it's invalid. Get your money back and that's the end of the story. But the Gemara says in a few places, how much is considered overcharging? Instead of charging you 100, I charge you 102 shekel. I overcharge you by 2%. Is that considered a deal breaker? You know, it's a mekach tos. It's the whole premise. You know, it undermines the whole premise of the sale. So the Gemara has a concept called what? Shtus, not shtus with a tes, which means stupidity. Shtus with a tav, which means 1/6. If I overcharge you by 1/6, which is approximately, again, this is not accurate, but it's approximately 16%, then you have a right to, the buyer who overpaid has a right to cancel the mech. Says Rav Zilberstein, that percentage, which is called 1/6, is called significant enough that it's a deal breaker. And from this, he wants to extrapolate that when the Torah considers percentages, what's considered a significant percentage, it's got to be above a shtus, or shtus and above, I should say. So we now have a statistical probability. Now, I'm not telling you that in every case I can reduce it, you know, scientifically to percentages, but at least we have a light at the end of the tunnel, we have a guiding rule. In any case where you have to risk your life, the question is, what's considered halachically a risk? And the answer is there a statistical probability of 16% of one shtus? That's considered a risk. You're not required to take this risk. And I personally would add the Meshech Chachma. You remember I mentioned this Meshech Chachma to you, but I'm so in love with this Meshech Chachma, from Meir Simcha Mitvinsk. Now it's called Dagopolsk, so if you go to Russia. And Rabbi Simcha was one of the giants of his time. He asks a question, again, this I'm just giving you the tip of the iceberg. Why is it that a woman is exempt from having children? Again, I would never have the chutzpah to ask that question because I'm not Rabbi Simcha, but he had the chutzpah to ask this question. And he claims that for a woman to get pregnant means that she's taking a life-endangering risk upon herself. So I asked myself, what, you know, I don't have the statistical answer to this question. I don't know if you can Google it and find out. Chas v'shalom, what percentage of women who give birth die in childbirth? I don't know what the percentage is. I would think, again, tell me if I'm wrong, it's 1 in 1,000, or maybe 1 in 10,000. I don't know. I don't have access to that. But if you turn back the clock 100 years, unfortunately, it was quite common. So when a woman gets pregnant, she endangers her life. It's more than 16% if you take Rav Zilberstein's evaluation. Now, the Torah says, I can't obligate a woman to put her life into danger. The man, his life is not in danger. Fascinating. Now, if you turn this to the second side of the page here, you'll see that we have on the top the Yushalmi that we mentioned before. The Yushalmi talks about Rav Imi, who is the Gadol Hador, and he was taken captive. And the Gemara says, we might as well start preparing his tachrichim, because he's not going to survive it. And then Rav Shim ben Lakish says, you know what, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to save him. Either I'll die, or they'll die, and I'll kill them and save Rav Imi. And that's what he did, and he saved Rav Imi. So the Rambam codifies this in Hilchos Rotzech, the second source on page 2. For those who like to see a source inside, I'd like you to take this home and look at it when you have more time. Kol ha'yochel ha'atzil. Anyone who has the ability to save someone's life, alo hitzil, and he didn't do so, over alo tamod al damreyecha, he violates this isur, this prohibition that the Torah says you can't be idle and mind your own business. And then the Rambam says, if he can't do it himself, yaskir acherim latzilo, he should hire someone else who can who can save his life. If you take a look at the Kesef Mishnah on the side, there's a little pointer there. You'll see that he quotes that Dagos Maimonios that we mentioned earlier, who quotes in turn he quotes the Yushalmi, that afilu lahachnis atzmo besofek sakon chayo, even to put his life into a dangerous situation, he has to endanger his life to save someone else's life. And this is omitted, as we said before, in the poskim. The Kesef Mishnah adds v'nireh, it seems to me, shatam, now you're moving over to the left column, mipnei she halav adai v'hu safek, because he's going to definitely perish and you may or may not perish. Those are some of the main sources that we have to see. Now, what is the final ruling? The Mishnah Berurah, which is on your page 3, if you happen to have that page, it's about the third source on page 3, says the following. The issue was violating the Shabbos in order to save someone. And the halacha is that no matter how slim the chances are, if you're actually saving someone, we will still violate the Shabbos. So when it comes to Pikuach Nefesh, being Doche Shabbos, to override the Shabbos, any possible, faint, distant possibility is enough to override the Shabbos. However, the Mishnah Berurah has another proviso here. But what if Yesh Sakana Lamatzil, to save him, you'd be putting your life into danger? Says the Mishnah Berurah, Eino Mechuyah. He's not obligated to put his life into danger to save someone else. Dechayav kodem l'chay chaver. Without even quoting Rabbi Akiva, he mentions the words of Rabbi Akiva. V'afilu safek sakana. Even if it only means a doubt, maybe he'll perish. Nami, so too, adif sveko didei mivadi dechem. It's more powerful, his safek, than the vadei of his friend. He knows his friend is going to perish. He will, if he saves him, he might die, doesn't have to die. In other words, the Mishnah Berurah is going against the Kesef Mishnah, which again, we might be comfortable with that because the Kesef Mishnah did not add this point in his Shulchan Aruch. But then he writes, Ulam, however, tzarch lishkol advarim heitev. Don't jump the gun and say, well, you know what, my life is going to be in danger, I might die. No. Think about it over and over again. Weigh it. Think about it. In Yesh Bo Sofek Sakana, is it really, really a Sofek Sakana? V'lo l'dagdik b'yoser. Don't be so careful in protecting your own life. Because if you're going to be so careful about your own life and the possible risk, somebody else is going to die as a result. And the Jewish religion puts so much emphasis on saving someone's life. And I'll answer your question just one second. If you look in the bottom of page 3, the Aruch HaShulchan, as I told you, Rav Epstein, who lived a century ago, he writes that Muchach, we see clearly, She'eno Chayev, he's not obligated to put his life into danger. Umiu, however, Kolofi Inyan, don't jump the gun. Lishkola Inyan Bepelis, he should really be honest with himself and weigh the chances. Velo Yishmaris Atzmo Yosef, he died, don't be so protective of yourself. And therefore, he says that if it's possible for you to assume that you won't perish, and that's where the percentages seem to lie, you should put your life into danger in order to save someone else who's definitely going to die if you do nothing. Goyim is a different story. Then it comes under what's called Eva. Eva means the following. The literal translation of Eva is hatred. So for example, if you're a Jewish physician, according to the strict letter of the law, if there's a patient who's not Jewish, you would not violate the Shabbos to save him. That's the strict letter of the law. But then the Gemara adds another element to the equation, which is called Eva. Eva means, could you imagine, if a physician is not going to, when he's doing his rounds, he's not going to violate the Shabbos because it's a guy. What does that mean? Well, quid pro quo, the guy is not going to save a Jew. This is going to create, ultimately, a tremendous peril for the Jewish community, so that also comes under Bikur Nefesh. Let me just say a few words about Rosh Hashanah, because I don't know if you're feeling it. I hope you are. I mean, we've gone through the entire month of Elul Kemat, you know, and this is the preparation for Rosh Hashanah. What can we say? What can we say about Rosh Hashanah? How many holidays? I'm just quizzing you. I'm testing you. How many holidays in the Hebrew calendar fall on Rosh Chodesh? Let's go through them. Sukkot is on what day of the month? The 15th of the month. Pesach is on what day of the month? The 15th of the month. Shavuos is on the 6th of the month. There's only one exception. And what's that? Rosh Hashanah. Only Rosh Hashanah coincides with Rosh Chodesh. And the question is this coincidental? Is there something inherent in Rosh Chodesh that impacts on Rosh Hashanah? And it's not coincidental that the divine being saw to it that the day of judgment, which is Rosh Hashanah, should coincide with Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the month. What is the logical connection between Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Chodesh? Now keep in mind, I would not have the chutzpah to ask this question except for the fact that David HaMelech describes Rosh Hashanah as Bekesel Yom Chagenu. Kesel means kasui. Kisui means it's covered. Rosh Hashanah is covered. Why? Because in any other holiday you can see the moon. We operate in Jewish law with a lunar calendar. But there's one exception. There's one holiday in which the moon is totally invisible at the time of the holiday, and that's Rosh Hashanah, because it's the first of Elul. Look for the moon on Rosh Hashanah, you won't find it, because that's the nature of Rosh Chodesh. So you see already in the verse, there's some description of the essence of Rosh Hashanah as being Bekesel Yom Chagenu. It's Bekesel, we don't see the moon. That's what Rosh Chodesh is all about. What is the significance of not seeing the moon? Is there anyone here in this room who feels compassion for the moon? Well, at least one hand went up. My heart goes out for the moon. Now, you said before, how could you drink the water and let someone perish? I can't understand how the moon could be totally invisible. The sun is never invisible. It only means that because of the rotation of the earth, at some point we don't see the sun, but the sun is very much alive. Now the Pasuk says, and God declares at the beginning of Genesis, I will create Shnei Ma'oros Gidolim. I'm not making that up for the purpose of this drasha. The Pasuk describes these two luminaries, the sun and the moon, as Gidolim. But the next Pasuk says, Es Ha'ma'ora Gadol, Es Ha'ma'ora Katan. I don't get it. You just finished telling me that it was the divine intention to create two gedolim, two great luminaries, two great stars. And yet, now the Torah goes ahead and describes the moon as a very small body. So who asks this question? The Gemara asks this question. I may have fooled you into thinking that this was the brilliance of Berzon. It's not. It's the Gemara in Chulin, Adaf Samach. The Gemara says, what's going on? How do we reconcile these two psukim? And the Gemara in Chulin says something mind-boggling. Originally, in the original divine plan, God was scheming and intending to create the moon as a Ma'ar Gadol. It would be in no way inferior to the sun itself. But then something happened. And the moon came forward and said to the Ribbono Shalom, Ein Shnei Ksarim Mishamshim B'Kesarecha. You can't have two kings that rule simultaneously. You can't tell me Likud and blue and white at the same time. You've got to decide who's going to be the Gadol. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you know what? If that's your attitude, then Lech V'Tam'iti Etzasmech. You should shrink. Now, who remembers the movie Honey, I Shrunk the King? I Shrunk the Kids. You remember that? Okay, we now have a new movie based on the Gemara Chulin. I Shrunk the Moon. Who shrunk the moon? HaKadosh Baruch Hu shrunk the moon. So the Gemara tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu begs the Jewish people to bring a kapara, an atonement. Al Shem Mi'atati Esayorei. what does that mean? Here's where we border on kfirah, on apikorsis. I mean, God is asking the people of Israel to bring a kapara on his behalf, his with a capital H, because he shrunk the moon. And the Gemara says that the Jewish people complied with God's request, and every Rosh Chodesh, when the moon is totally invisible, we bring a separate carbon, which is called the Sa'ir of Rosh Chodesh, the He-Goat of Rosh Chodesh, which is a kapara for the sin of the Ribbono Shel Olam, because the Ribbono Shel Olam shrunk the moon. Now, I'm not here to explain this philosophically, because it's very problematic. How can you say about the Ribbono Shel Olam that he himself needs a kaparat atonement? But I can tell you what's going on over here. The fact that Rosh Hashanah is the day of judgment is a very scary enterprise. Because the Yerushalmi famously said that what do we do with a sinner? So we turn first to Chachma and we ask wisdom, the angel of wisdom, what should we do with a sinner? And he says, Tirdof Ra, he's going to have evil all his life. He's a sinner. It's irreversible. They turn to Nevuah, to prophecy. And prophecy said, Nefesh Achotas Tomus. He forfeited his right to exist. He's a sinner. He rebelled against God. And then they turn to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, Yaseh Tshuva Miskapir. There is such a thing as Kapar. There is atonement for a person who does tshuva. So the Makatrigim, the prosecutors, came in front of the Ribbono and they said to him, but the verse in your Torah says, Melech Yamid B'Mishpat, that a Melech goes through Mishpat. Mishpat means serious and strict justice. There is no room for Kapara. There is no room for tshuva. Man's sins are irreversible. You can't change the past. V'anefesh HaKotas Tomus. So the Ribbono Shel Olam says to the prosecutors in the Medrash that if you deny the concept, the enterprise of Kapara, the possibility of Kapara, then I'm in deep trouble, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, because I need Kapara. Shemi atati es hayareach. And on Rosh Chodesh, we bring the Sayir Lechatos, and the Pasuk says, Lashem, on behalf of God. This is a trailblazer. This is the breakthrough. God says, I sinned, kaviyach, or whatever that means, and therefore I need a kapara. If you're going to deny the entity of kapara, the possibility of atonement, then says the Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm in deep trouble. Therefore, God combines Rosh Hashanah, the day of judgment, with Rosh Chodesh. Why? Because this is our only chance on Rosh Hashanah. We turn to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And we say to him, give us an opportunity to do kapara. You yourself said, what's the story with a chote? Is yavi chatos v'yiskaper. He should bring a korban. He should do tshuva. Today we don't have a base of English, we have tshuva. And if we repent, there will be kapara, the Ribbono Shel Olam says. But what is the breakthrough? How do we undermine the argument, the tie of the prosecutors, the makachugim? There is no room to change the past. Mishpat, it says, Melech, Mishpat. And the answer is that God, Kaviyochel, put himself into a situation where he himself, Kaviyochel, needs Kapara. He shrunk the moon. So I leave you today with this message. Honey, I shrunk the moon. And that is the message of Bekesa Liyom Chagenu, that Rosh Hashanah coincides with Bekesa when the moon is not there, because that's the most profound expression of Mi'atati Es Hayareah. And we turn to the Ribbono Shel Olam in great supplication, and we say on Rosh Hashanah, God, you have to give us the opportunity for Kapara, for atonement on this day of judgment, because you yourself, Kaviyochel, need that Kapara. He wrote some of his will, then on this day of Rosh Hashanah that's fast and approaching, we'll all be soaked and merit the kapara, the great atonement through our tshuva, will be written in the book of Chaim, of Nachas and Shalom, for ourselves, our mishpachas, and for all of Kali Sorkeni Ratzon. So this ends the series on matters of life and death. And we'll see if anyone's around on Leil Rosh Hashanah Rabbah, I'll be giving a lecture on Rosh Hashanah.